You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and children of all ages, to the Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you each week right here on RadioAryan.com, where we bring you news and political commentary, which you will not find anywhere else except for on the Rope Report websites, which you can access through whitenationalists.com. This week on the Rope Report, we'll be talking about Hurricane Irma and Jeff Sessions and DACA, along with Donald Trump and the unlimited debt ceiling. But first, readers have asked me to discuss my books, the 14 published fiction and nonfiction volumes that are available through Amazon.com or through Barnes & Noble Booksellers or Books A Million or through Lulu.com or just by going to your Google Monster and typing in Billy Roper Books. Now, a lot of the books that I have written talk about the future Balkanization and breakup of the United States of America. These books all carry forward a pro-white message because I want to prepare our people for what is inevitably coming. But I use both fiction and nonfiction, literally historical fiction and science fiction, as well as autobiography and historical nonfiction to try to get the message across through different genres in ways that will be palatable to different people, depending on what kind of books they normally read. So I have some books that I've written and published which might be more interesting for those who are of a scholarly bent. For example, this morning I was on the Stormfront Radio and I was asking Dr. Slattery and Father Francis if they had had an opportunity to read my first published book, Paleo-American Ethnic Diversity. Now, Paleo-American Ethnic Diversity was the book that I actually wrote as my master's thesis way back in 1999. So as I held the mammoth still and its trunk was wrapped around the stone tablet that I chiseled this thesis on back in 1999, I was attempting to undo what's considered to be by many the first original sin of white people in North America, and that is the genocide, the slaughter, the conquering of the poor noble savages, the innocent red man, Native Americans, because I was putting forward at that time the Salutrian hypothesis, which has been supported since then over the last 20 years by a lot more anthropological and archaeological research. The Salutrian hypothesis is that whites from Europe, known as Salutrians, crossed over the North Atlantic through ice floes and on boats made of hide 10,000 years ago, and they went into North America, which at that time was unoccupied by anyone, and spread eastwards in southern, northern, western North America, eventually occupying a lot of the continent. But their most dense population remained on the East Coast, where it was in closer proximity to Europe, where the entry point into North America was at that period of the Ice Age. Of course, later on, by later on I mean 4,000 to 5,000 years later, some Stone Age savages, the Asians, the Mongolians, got lost following a herd of lunch and wandered across the Bering Strait, the Bering Land Bridge, at that time, into North America, coming down through Canada and into the west coast of the United States. And when they came to the numerically inferior, but technologically superior, Salutrian whites who were already there, they genocided them. In some cases, they assimilated and interbred with them. But for the most part, they killed them off. And my research to support that thesis was based on things like Kennewick Man and Spirit Cave Man and other archaeological finds in North America dating back further than the several thousand years of history of the Asians being here, the quote-unquote Native Americans having been here, and the fact that all of the human remains found in North America older than 5,000 years old have all been of Caucasians. So obviously, whenever people talk about the horrible whites committing genocide against the peaceful American Indians who practiced slavery and cannibalism and murdered each other indiscriminately. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson wrote that they were primitive Indian savages whose preferred method of warfare was indiscriminate slaughter of every age and gender. Well, that was just their human nature, as being Asian savages. But it was not an original sin for our colonial ancestors to eradicate them, because, for the first hand, most of the Eastern Woodlands Indians, like the Powhatan Confederacy and the Iroquois, were white. Literally, they were white Indians, primarily in the Northeast, and even in spotted clusters throughout the Midwest, such as the Mandans. Further west, they were almost exclusively Asian, and a Mongolian-looking Asian at that. And in the South and the Southeast, they had assimilated so that they were part white and part Asian. But the Northeastern tribes were still white, as were some others. But the Salutrian hypothesis, which has since been supported by a lot more research and other writers, was first expounded in the late 1990s. And my master's thesis, Paleo-American Ethnic Diversity, as I was talking about on the radio this morning, was one of the first scholarly books, once it was published, to talk directly about the Paleolithic whites who came from Europe into North America and who were here first before the Asians crossed the Bering Land Bridge and committed genocide against them. Now, it's not that we're trying to compete for victimhood status with the Native Americans, quote unquote, or anyone else. We are Aryans, we are conquerors, we should not try to portray ourselves as victims or feel that we are more victims than anyone else. But as a psychological tool, we can tell them that perhaps our ancestors did conquer the Native Americans, yours, but yours who came here not only committed slavery and cannibalism on one another, they also genocided the whites who were here first. And all races, all peoples have been both conquerors and conquered, been both slaveholders, including the Native Americans, as well as slaves at one time or another in their history. Morality and ethics are subjective, except that objectively we have contributed more to human civilization and technology and science and medicine technology than anyone else, any other race has. And we also have done more to alleviate universal human suffering, including slavery, than any other race has. But be that as it may, we can disarm some of the noble red savage myth and some of the Cherokee princess myth that unfortunately too many of our whites are saddled with by pointing out to them the now scientifically accepted fact that whites from Europe were here in North America first and that they were then genocided by the Asian Native Americans who crossed the Bering Strait. So that was my first book, Paleo-American Ethnic Diversity. And it runs about $6 or so on Amazon. But my most popular book, my best-selling book, is a book called Hasten the Day. And it was the first fiction book that I published. And I don't know if it's just because it's been out there longer, so it's had more exposure over the last 4 years or so since it was published, or whether it's actually just grown and snowballed in momentum and popularity, but I've sold more copies of Hasten the Day than I have any of my other books, including my nonfiction books. And a lot of people in the white nationalist movement actually prefer to read nonfiction books rather than fiction books, because they think that, you know, nonfiction books by definition are more serious. And they may have a point in that. But in the Hasten the Day novel, I wanted to talk about another of my major theories. And it's not a theory about the past, but rather it's a theory or a projection, a prognosis or a prophecy, if you will, about the future. And this prophecy is not based on faith. It's based on my study of demographic projections and census data indicating that people in the United States are voluntarily voting with their feet. They are separating themselves from one another by migrating into areas where they are, their people are, the majority. I'll give you an example. As non-white Latino Hispanics flood into the southwestern states, into the border states, then whites in California and in those southwestern states are responding by moving out of those border states and into the far west and into the upper west, into the Pacific Northwest, to get away from those majority Hispanic areas. That means that the Southwest becomes more and more Latino, more and more brown, because of more brown people coming in and white people moving out. And those western states are becoming whiter by percentage because of the white people moving in, increasing the white percentage in those states. A similar phenomenon is happening in the southeastern United States of America, where African Americans are moving out of New York and Chicago, out of the cities of the Midwest and the Northeast, back to the Deep South, back to Dixie, and reestablishing what for a couple generations they've been trying to build up as a New Africa in the former Confederate states of the Deep South, where they already are within a few degree points of becoming the majority. And as that happens, there's a response by the whites there who are indulging in white flight, not just from the inner cities to the suburbs or then from the suburbs to rural areas. They try to commute for longer distances, if they have to get further away from black neighborhoods as those black neighborhoods expand, but actually to move regionally out of extreme southeastern Dixie states back to the upper South. And the two states that have benefited most from this migration of whites out of the Deep South as it becomes blacker have been Tennessee and Arkansas, where I live. And I can tell you that especially here in northern Arkansas, which is already overwhelmingly majority white, my county, for example, is 97% white and growing. Every county around my county is over 95% white. Most of the population growth in mine and in adjoining counties is from white people who are moving out of Mississippi and Louisiana, moving north into northern Arkansas, into the Ozarks, to get away from the growing black populations in those areas and all the wonderful blessings and benefits of diversity which that growing black population brings with them. You know, things like lower educational levels, more violent schools, crime, you know, being raped and mugged and murdered is just a turnoff for a lot of people for some reason. So they move to places like here in northern Arkansas, and they move to similar regions in Tennessee, out of Alabama and Georgia. And this phenomenon of the southeastern states becoming more and more black is giving birth to New Africa. And is making the Upper South, by percentage, whiter. Now, in areas like the Far West and in the Northeast, things are more mixed. Things are clustered into smaller enclaves where you'll have whites and blacks and brown and yellow people separating themselves out into neighborhoods and maybe even into county-sized regions of white flight or reverse gentrification. But for the most part, you're seeing three large areas coalescing and purifying themselves voluntarily through internal migration of blacks into the Southeast and whites responding by moving out to the Upper South, brown Latinos moving into the Southwest, and whites responding by moving out into the Upper West and the Pacific Northwest, and Asians congregating on the West Coast, which is probably where they'll get the most reinforcements anyway when America breaks down. So that first fiction book that I wrote called Hasten the Day was about the first year of the Balkanization of America. Balkanization being the term referring to what happened really in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s when they had a three- or four-way civil war which broke up that artificial multi-ethnic country of Yugoslavia into several now independent and much happier, smaller, ethnically-based countries. And that's the future that I foresaw for the United States of America. As America polarized, divided, had a civil war after economic collapse, and then broke apart into several different countries. And I envisioned the rise of Deseret as a Mormon nation out west, centered around Utah and the surrounding Mormon area there. I envisioned Hispanics taking over the Southwest, and then the Chinese invading the West Coast and fighting with them there. I envisioned blacks taking over portions of the Deep South to establish New Africa, and a new white nation called New America, stretching throughout the Midwest and the Heartland, the Red States, what the liberals on the East Coast call Flyover America. As I talked about the way this would develop, I did a, I think, fairly good job of character development and plot contrivances to make it readable enough and interesting enough that, as I said, it is still my best-selling book. But it talks about the first year of the Balkanization of America. Now, the second part of that story, which was actually demanded by readers who wanted to know what would happen next in America and what would happen to the characters that I introduced to them in Hasten the Day, I wrote Waiting for the Sun. Now, Waiting for the Sun is a sequel to Hasten the Day, part two of the story, and it talks about 5 years after the Balkanization of America, 5 years after the end of the primary civil war, which causes the collapse of the national government and the rise of regional governments, which are ethnically based, as there are actually three competing white ethnostates at this time in North America, as well as a brown and a black ethnostate, and mixed multiracial cosmopolitan areas as well. And there are also foreign powers and intrigues as far as the United Nations and the Republic of China and our European allies go that are introduced. And we talk about how those would interplay. So Waiting for the Sun is the sequel to Hasten the Day, and it's 5 years after the breakup of America as these new white nations and other nations rise. The third book in what would become the Hasten the Day trilogy is called Wasting the Dawn. And Wasting the Dawn is part three. It's the third and conclusive installment in the Hasten the Day trilogy. It continues what would be, by many people's standards, a dystopian speculative fiction saga, which, you know, began in Hasten the Day and then continued in Waiting for the Sun. It's after that economic collapse, the Civil War, global chaos ensues, and 80% of the world's population, because of starvation and war, is actually dead. In the aftermath, you know, the familiar characters from Part 1 and Part 2, from Hasten the Day and Waiting for the Sun, develop their own nations. They rise to be global powers. So within a decade, within a generation of the collapse of the United States of America, you find New America rising to the forefront of global issues and affairs and helping our European allies to throw off their invaders and to regain control of their own destinies as nations as well, to make good trading partners and good kinsmen allies. So that carries it forward through the next generation. And then hasten the day, waiting for the sun, and wasting the dawn was actually joined together into the three-part trilogy anthology, which is also sold as one volume through Amazon and Books A Million and Barnes & Noble booksellers. If you're interested in how I began writing fiction, that might be a good place to start. A lot of people find the Hasten the Day trilogy to be some of my best writing. I'll leave that to your judgment. If you like historical fiction, and if you're a fan of the HBO series The Vikings, or if you like reading the old Norse sagas, the Icelandic sagas, then you might enjoy a historical fiction book that I wrote called Glöms Saga. And Glöms Saga was inspired by a state park, which is still in Hevener, Oklahoma. And this state park is on a mountain. You drive up a mountain, and there's a valley with rocky cliffs on each side. There's a small museum where they exhibit some small rune stones that have been found in that area of Oklahoma. And inside that valley is a giant rune stone where the carving was made, depending on whose date you go with, perhaps 1,000 years ago, by Vikings who were in the area. And it's a property claim, claiming that that valley below the mountain is Glomsdale, belongs to a Viking named Glom. And the theory is that at least one ship of Norsemen traveled across the Atlantic, up through the Gulf of Mexico, to the Mississippi River, up the Mississippi River to the Arkansas River, and from the Arkansas River to the Red River, which they could have gotten within just a few miles of that mountain. And one does not know if they eventually gave up and returned home, or if they were wiped out by local Indian tribes, or if they interbred with them. It's hard to say. There are many similar rune stones like that in that area of Oklahoma, and I'm proud to say that I've been able several times to visit them and to do a lot of research in person. It's really amazing. You know, I have never been to Sweden or to Norway or even to the areas of England where you can actually touch a runestone carved by our Viking ancestors. So I went to Oklahoma instead and saw them there. And I encourage you, if you have an opportunity to visit Hevener, Oklahoma, and the Hevener Runestone Park there, so you can see it for yourself. But that's what really inspired my book, Glöms Saga. And I then carry it forward in historical fiction fashion to explore what very well may have happened to Glom and to his crew afterwards, after that runestone was carved. Now, if you don't like historical fiction, if you like things that are a little bit more straightforward, then a lot of people don't have an opportunity to write their autobiography. They wait too long. They think they're going to write it at the end of their life when they have more to tell, a more complete story. And then before they know it, the end of their life comes before they're quite ready for it to, and they never get that chance to write memoirs. And I did not want that to happen in my case, because I felt like that I have been misunderstood enough as a writer and as an activist and as a politician, as a statesman, if you will, while I was still alive, without being misunderstood even further after I was dead. And that's why before I had an opportunity to die on myself, and surprise, I would actually write my autobiography. And I entitled it The Ice Path. And trying to have some honest, open, forthright, objective introspection is hard. You know, there's an old Scottish saying that God give us the gift to see ourselves as others see us, and none of us can really do that. It's hard to judge yourself fairly. But I tried. And so I actually wrote my autobiography up to the point of a couple of years ago, trying to explain how I got to be this way, how I got to be such an evil, racist Nazi that wants to kill 6 Karelian Jews, right? And I also interspersed each nonfiction chapter about my life and my autobiography with a fictional account going once again back to the Solutrean hypothesis and the original white inhabitants of North America coming forward to whites as Vikings exploring North America, then white colonial explorers coming into North America, and then pioneers spreading across North America, but all tied together through a united thread that I think makes an interesting novella interspersal between the non-fictional chapters. So it talks about English colonists and Viking explorers and the white Solutreans, as well as myself. And if you ever want to really understand the mindset of someone like me, then a lot of people think that the ice path, a way forward, is a good way of doing so. One thing that I talk about in the ice path is the fact that I was born and raised in the South and that my ancestors fought for the Confederacy. I'm proud of that. And some of them died fighting for that noble lost cause, which we may regain. But when I think about my Southern ancestors, I think about that war. Obviously, mistakes were made, right? We can all agree to that. Some of the mistakes that were made in the Civil War and the fact that it could have so greatly and profoundly changed not just U.S. history, but world history had it gone differently in only so many minor ways, for example, at Gettysburg, has led a lot of people to write alternate history novels. And so I've always been fascinated by alternate histories, thinking about how the universe, human history certainly, could have gone differently had one or two small minor events played out in other ways than what we're familiar with having happened. And so I wrote an alternate history novel called Look Away, an alternate history of the Civil War. And what I talked about as being the breaking point, the point of change from our reality, if you want to think of them as being parallel universes in the multiverse, is that Mary Todd Lincoln had a really bad night with her nervous fits and kept Honest Abe up pacing in the White House, which caused him to have a bad temper tantrum and to write a much harsher Emancipation Proclamation, which led to slave uprisings and revolts. And that much harsher Emancipation Proclamation and the resulting slave revolts led to greater reprisals and crackdown on blacks, which led to Confederate victory, but in an indirect way, because the way that I write Look Away, an alternate history of the Civil War, is that European powers get involved. Russia gets involved on the side of the Union, and other European powers get involved on the side of the Confederacy. So it actually turns into a global war, if you will, working off of the tensions and the entangling alliances that were already developing in Europe at that time that would have led in our reality, in our history, to World War I. Except in the book that I wrote, and Look Away, our Civil War brings all these allied European powers to a head in their confrontations about a generation earlier. So Austria gets involved as well. This makes it a world war before World War I. And I won't give away the ending, but I think that Southern patriots will be very interested and pleased with the curious outcome of Look Away, an alternate history of the Civil War. Ultimately, then, I had to switch gears back into nonfiction. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I had talked about what motivated me to write the Haste in the Day trilogy. This impending, inevitable, from my view, breakup of America after the polarization and the balkanization, which is right now going on and accelerating faster than I have ever seen it before. More and more people are talking about another civil war happening here in America. more and more people are talking about ethnic conflict and even a racial war aspect and component of that coming civil war. It won't be Democrats versus Republicans. It won't necessarily be red states versus blue states. I'm sorry to disappoint the civic nationalists, but it's going to get bloody. And it's going to become racial, even if it begins with an economic collapse or an EMP attack. It's going to turn racial, because wars always do. And there's so much ethnic tension and racial hatred right now on all sides, that it's inevitably going to become a racial civil war. And so I wrote in the Balk, B-A-L-K, about my Balkanization theory. And I have become, over the last several years, I believe, within the white nationalist movement, the single largest, or at least most prolific, proponent of the Balkanization theory. And that is simply, as I said, that the United States of America is inevitably going to break up from a multiracial large democracy, if you will, into several smaller, more ethnically based states. And that's probably not going to happen peacefully through secession or voluntarily through the federal government abdicating power, as George III did, but rather through a collapse of power, a vacuum of power at the federal level, allowing whatever the vehicle or crisis scenario is that would allow that, allowing the Balkanization of America. So I talked about in the Balk, which is subtitled What It Means and What It Means for America's Future, that demographic statistics and shifting census data have continued over the last two censuses, or the last 20 years, to indicate that growing political polarization, racial tensions, and the element of change in America's culture and society has been brought on by both legal and illegal immigration. Think about what's happening now with DACA and the Dreamers. And this is all leading towards the Balkanization of America. So there'll be looting and riots and culture wars and that looming minority majority we're all staring at. So I try to talk about, almost like this is a survivalist prepper's manual. I first established in the first half of the book what's going to happen and why it will happen and the inevitability, the certainty of it happening. And then I talk about what people can do to prepare for it, to save themselves and their families. So I can tell them what that would mean for themselves and for their future and for our nation. So if they could try to begin to get their head around what's coming and prepare everyone who reads the Balk, prepare them to survive the collapse and breakup of the United States. I mean, this is the book that Thomas Chittum, the author of Civil War II, would write today if he wasn't so politically correct, honestly. So if you're one of those people, like myself, who does not believe that the United States of America will last another 100 years, or another 50 years, or another 20 years, then I recommend that you read the Balk, B-A-L-K, What It Means and What It Means for America's Future. And it happens to be my best-selling nonfiction book at the moment. Now, dealing with the idea of Balkanization and trying to promote it once again through a fictional, more lighthearted, if you will, or palatable manner, I wrote a book called The Fifth Horseman. And The Fifth Horseman is a post-apocalyptic science fiction novel. It's set in the near future in northern Arkansas, because you're supposed to write what you know, right? So after an economic collapse and an EMP attack and a limited nuclear war bring racial civil warfare and the collapse of society in America, the name is really refused to refer to the fall of civilization prior to this, but now it's becoming more and more acceptable, and people are not refusing to refer to Balkanization. They're actually using it in mainstream media articles. But in The Fifth Horseman, I go a step further than people are willing to face. I talk about the fact that tens of millions of people have died of starvation and disease and war, and the rest are divided through loyalties into neo-feudal city-states and their territories surrounding them, and they're all struggling for control over the few modern technological resources that remain. And there's one man in The Fifth Horseman who may be able to unite them all. After the war and the famine and pestilence and all the death, this guy is a preacher, a traveling circuit rider, referred to as the Fifth Horseman of the Apocalypse. So if you liked Clint Eastwood in Pale Rider and Kevin Costner in The Postman, you'd probably love The Fifth Horseman. Continuing on in the fiction genre, specifically in science fiction, I wrote a science fiction novel that's a little esoteric. It's definitely far future, called Remnants. And I talk about Remnants, so I describe it as being Blade Runner meets Idiocracy. It's another dystopian view of a future where political correctness has come full circle to bite its own tail. It's hard science fiction. It also has some romance and some post-apocalyptic adventure that I think fans of sci-fi will like. It's a controversial book, like all of mine are. It does have pro-white impulses within its subplots, and it has a lot of twists and turns along the way to a stunning and climactic finish. If you just fast forward half a millennium, 500 years, then you know you want to rewind and make sure that this story never comes true. It's not for the faint of heart or the dim of vision, but Remnants will definitely shake you up, especially if you like science fiction and space adventure. Now, when we talk about alternate reality and alternate histories and being able to change the past, to change the present, to change the future, you get into things like the grandfather paradox, the idea that you cannot really go back in time to change things because of a paradox that exists. If you were to go back into 100 years ago and meet your grandfather when he was a baby and kill him, then you could have never been born. If you could never have been born, then you could not have gone back in time to kill your grandfather when he was a baby, which would mean that you could have been born. If you were born, you could have gone back in time to kill your grandfather when he was a baby, which means you could not have been born. You could not have gone back in time. You see the paradox here? And the idea being, scientifically, in terms of physics as well, any instance which produces a self-negating paradox is ipso facto impossible and not reality. The solution to that, then, is the idea of the multiverse, the idea that you cannot change your own past or your own future, but you can create breaks from that timeline into different parallel realities, alternate histories with their own timelines, side by side by side. So if you picture the multiverse as being a bowl of spaghetti with all kinds of interknotted, interlooped lines, there are a million to our right or our left where the Confederates won the Civil War, the Germans won World War II, and I ate something different for breakfast. Minor changes, major changes, in different degrees of separation from our own reality. If you even conceive of time travel being possible at all. And what I wrote about in Deja Vu is that that feeling that we have of deja vu, that there's something that we are about to say or about to do, which we have done in the past or said in the past, that is actually the moment when our reality was changed. Because technologically, time travel may be inevitable at some point in the future. And at some point in the future, if there is a significantly important breaking point from our own reality to the new reality, that might be felt the same way that those of us who are old enough to remember old audio cassette tapes and how they could be recorded over. But sometimes when you record it over an audio cassette tape, there'd be a ghost recording left underneath your new recording that you could still faintly hear an echo of. And you could tell where that break had happened. That's what I write that the feeling of deja vu really is. It's about time travel. There are actually a first and second editions because when I first wrote Deja Vu, the first edition was, I guess, I was told, above the heads of the readers. They couldn't understand the technology involved, the way I described it. And so I had to rewrite Deja Vu with a second edition, which went a little bit deeper in understanding the plot and understanding the technology involved and making the changes in the past which affected our future. So, what if time travel was possible? I mean, have you ever wished that you could just start over and do things better the next time around? I think we all have. So it starts out with that feeling haunting a team of NASA scientists who are marooned on the moon in the year 2038 when their lunar base is cut off from Earth by a global economic and grid collapse. So faced with eventual starvation and death on the moon, like so many billions below them on the planet that's, you know, where those who have created civilization have become too small of a dwindling minority to sustain it, they face some really hard decisions about their future. And so necessity being the mother of invention, it leads them to even harder decisions about their past as they invent time travel. So deja vu, like I said, is that feeling that something that is happening or is about to happen has already been experienced before. So what if time travel, backwards only, was possible? And what if changes engineered from the future left small moments of that ghost memory where the past had been overwritten, like recording over that old-fashioned audio tape I mentioned? We might call that ghost memory or that overlap deja vu. And so he goes back in time to try to circumvent the collapse of civilization and ends up finding that these entanglements of changing the past take him to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and without giving away too much, all the way back to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ himself. So a lot of people think that deja vu is very high-tech sci-fi, hard-tech sci-fi, but it's more philosophical than technological. I don't get into the physics, the quantum mechanics of time travel as much as I do the possible ramifications of time travel. Now, another book which has been largely misunderstood, if I can say so, is a fiction book I wrote that actually has been talked about recently. It's my most recent published book called Commonwealth. And Commonwealth is also an alternate history novel, but it talks about how the future of America may have been different had the colonization of our nation gone in a different direction. It's illustrated very well by Michael Sheehan, and Commonwealth is it's a rollicking, tension-filled, alternate history, kind of a steampunk adventure novel. It features romance and adventure and espionage and suspense. It's really deeply researched. I spent several months, even as a historian, pouring into this every nuanced detail that I could about the 16th and 17th centuries. And basically, the American Revolution never happened. We Anglo-Americans are still British citizens, and part of the continent is also occupied by New France as well as by New Spain. So the European powers are still dominant. Slavery never became an institution in British America. So there are far fewer non-whites on the continent. So you can imagine an America where slavery never happened, where we're free of that indelible besmirchment on our national character. And by the way, we're still British. And that's the secret behind the change that I plugged into the Commonwealth. And it's a very romantic book about two star-crossed lovers, one from New France and the other from British America. But they are both very important to their young nations and their nation's futures. But I'll let you read Commonwealth if you'd like to see how that story plays out. The other two nonfiction books that I've had published are General Population and The Big Picture. Now, General Population began also as, like I said, a strictly nonfiction book, but it morphed because I had begun writing to so many prisoners that I correspond with, so many POWs, white guys behind the wire, about the idea of writing a book to tell their stories. Writing a novel because it would be more popular, that would fictionalize some of their stories eventually became the only direction I could see out without doxing them, revealing too much of their information, and possibly causing them trouble with the warden or with the COs. And so I began to compile and combine the stories and experiences of dozens, literally about three dozen, about 38 different white prisoners' stories went into this book called General Population. And as I began to write it and try to incorporate their personal accounts and stories of everything they went into it, and I thought, well, what's going to be the selling point? What's going to bring this together and make it interesting for people to read? And again, you know, it has to have a plot. It can't just be a collection of short stories. That's been overdone. So I had to fictionalize their accounts and pull them together into one narrative. And the narrative became the book, which was called General Population. And it's the story of, once again, the breakup of America, the collapse of society. But imagine if you were locked inside prison when that happened. What would you do? If you saw society collapsing from through these prison bars and you could not get out to get to your family or to get to safety, you were literally locked in a cage. What would you do? So General Population has been called the politically incorrect drunken love child of Stephen King and Alfred Hitchcock by one reviewer. It's a story of a guy named Max Ott. Excuse me, A-U-G-H-T. And Max is a young prisoner who's locked in a really corrupt and brutal prison system because he attempted to kill a child molester who raped his little sister. So as society, you know, begins to unravel and collapse on the outside, the guys like Max that are locked up may, it turns out, be the best hope for our future if only they can survive to regain their freedom. It contains, like I said, anecdotal stories and input from over three dozen currently incarcerated contributors and a few that have gained their freedom since I began writing it. So grimly realistic in its depictions of the best and worst of humanity, but General Population is a story of the best of us and the worst of us on both sides of the wire. It also has a very surprising ending, which may throw you for a loop, but I feel, and a lot of reviewers feel, only reinforces the importance of making sure that those of us who have our freedom prepare for what is coming, as well as try to help those who are not in the position to help themselves. And then finally, my most recent nonfiction book that's been published is The Big Picture. And The Big Picture is really the alt-right's Bible. It's a handbook for white nationalism. It is my attempt to encapsulate my ideas about the most effective use of propaganda and optics at public demonstrations and rallies and protests with how to reach our people using the internet, social media, and direct face-to-face meetings in real life to inspire camaraderie and trust and teamwork. So The Big Picture, more than any book that I have written, would be my legacy as an instructional novel, an instructional tome on how to do things, how to be a leader, how to organize. And obviously, not everyone will agree with every point that I make in this. It's based on everything that I have learned from David Lane, and Pastor Richard Butler, and obviously Dr. William Pierce, as well as other men who have influenced me a lot in my life that I learned from in person, face to face. And you can learn something from everyone, including from me. You can learn either how to, or if you disagree, you can learn how not to. If you see something that I did not work out well, it was a failure, then you can learn to avoid those pitfalls. And that's one of the things I write about in The Big Picture, is the importance of not making WN 2.0 or the alt-right having to reinvent the wheel and to recreate all of our mistakes on the way to hopefully eclipsing and carrying forward our successes. Because it's true that, you know, you cannot see any further than anyone else unless you're standing on the shoulders of giants. And I'd like for them all to accomplish more than we have, just as we all want our children to have better lives and be more successful than we have been. They can only do that by learning from the past, all too many of them are ignorant of the history of the white nationalist movement and what came before them. And it would behoove them to learn from everything that we've done, win and lose. And that's why I really think that the big picture is worth reading. So I have 14, actually, published fiction and nonfiction books that I encourage you to look into. If you find one that you'd like to put aside to read over the winter, depending on what genre you like, you can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNobleBooksellers.com or Books A Million or Lulu.com or just Google Billy Roper author or Billy Roper's books and pick out one. And from now until September the 25th, 50% of all the royalties from the books that I sell will go to Hurricane Harvey relief to white Texans in the flood zones. Now, that's enough about my books. Let's talk for a minute about whitenationalist.com and your ability to get daily updated news and political articles written by myself that you'll not hear anywhere else from perspective just to the right of Julia Stryker. And you can also go to theropereport.wordpress.com and to theropereport.whitenationalist.net. Or the simplest is whitenationalist.com. I want to mention just a minute that Jeff Sessions said publicly in mainstream media, the Attorney General said that DACA, deferred action on illegal aliens who were brought here before they were 18, was unconstitutional, that Barack Obama broke the law, that it's only Congress that can change immigration statutes, and he's quite correct. But what Trump has done now has given the U.S. Senate 6 months to save DACA. What the Democrats are going to do, along with the 18 liberal rhino Republicans in name only, Republicans like Jeff Flake and John McCain, they're going to attach riders to every bill over the next 6 months if the Senate goes to before them to have the Dreamers given amnesty. Now, it's not just that there's 800,000 of these illegal immigrants who were brought here before they were 18. It's the fact that if 100% of their immediate families are then bound to them, you have a reversal of the anchor baby syndrome where you have anchor parent syndrome now. And that means that instead of just 800,000 illegal immigrants becoming citizens, you're going to have their immediate family stuck as well because you can't break up a family, can you? Which means that 5.4 illegal immigrants will be here in the United States with pathways to citizenship. That would mean that Texas and Florida and Pennsylvania and Ohio, which are now red states, in other words, they often vote Republican, would go blue. Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio going blue would mean that it would be impossible for any Republican to the right of Mitch McConnell to ever be elected again in the United States of America because of the weight of their electoral votes in the process. So giving amnesty to these DACA kids and teenagers and 20-somethings would not just be a bad thing for those 800,000 new Americans or for the rest of us who'd have to support the 72% of them who are still living on welfare, who have never gotten a job. But it would be a bad thing for America because it would mean that we would never again have an opportunity to have even a conservative president. But it would be a good thing for white Americans because it would speed up and make more inevitable and accelerated the collapse of any trust in a voting solution out of this mess. And more white Americans would have to accept that they're not going to be able to go to the ballot box and save themselves and save their children's futures. To secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, it would then become more obvious than ever that the ballot box is not the ticket out. The cartridge box is the only ticket out. So I say, let them give the Dreamers and the DACA kids amnesty. The Democrats are going to do it, folks. They've got a six-month window, and they will do it. And that's why Trump let the Senate have the opportunity to do it instead of just deporting them because he is not your savior. He is not your friend. Inevitably, though, this will close one of the final windows in their mind psychologically for white people to think that they could get any solution from the government, that they could petition the government for a redress of their grievances, as our founding father said, and will cement more firmly in their minds the necessity of divorce, separation, balkanization of the United States of America. So I say, worse is better. I say, let it come. Let them give the Dreamers amnesty. Let them give the DACA kids citizenship. Let those 800,000 kids and the resulting 5.4 million illegal immigrants of their families stay. Let them vote. Now, Trump has agreed to raise the federal debt limit, got screwed by Democrats on that one, in order to pay for Hurricane Harvey and for incoming Hurricane Irma and for his wall. Guess what? 2 out of 3 may not be bad in his mind, but he's not going to get a wall. 17.8 trillion. That's what the current federal budget deficit is. Now there's going to be no upward limit, no ceiling to it. And guess who's going to be buying those treasury bills, those T-bills, to finance the next wave of disaster relief or entitlement programs for these new DACA dreamers that are going to be citizens? Is going to come straight out of your pocket, and they're going to be financed by you buying more cheap Chinese junk in Walmart. The Chinese are going to use those profits to turn around and buy more treasury bills so they own more of our debt. And when they call it in, folks, that's like a loan. When they buy these treasury bonds and these treasury bills, they're buying up U.S. debt from the federal government. When they call in that debt, we're not going to be able to pay. We will have to repudiate that debt, and the Chinese may very well decide they'll take it out in territory. And I don't think they'll stop in Hollywood. This is one of the things we have to think about whenever we actually look at America's future and we write things. We cannot make these same mistakes over and over again. But for now, we can reconcile ourselves to the fact that everything that Trump is doing, everything that Congress is doing, is working towards the benefit of our people, because the inevitable victory is ours. It's been promised by God. There's nothing that anyone who is against us can do to stop it or to slow it down. It's accelerating every day. And even their actions against us are working in our benefit by making our ultimate separation from them more inevitable and more certain. So don't be depressed. Don't be black-pilled by DACA dreamers getting citizenship in a few months. It's going to happen. What it will do, you have to understand, is make sure we don't make this mistake, like the song says, don't get fooled again, and try to elect our way out of this mess. It's going to make it obvious to more people that that's not the solution. America must separate, it must balkanize, it must segregate. We must have our own white ethno-states, plural. So, until then, keep your eye on Washington and recognize everything that happens is moving us closer and closer to that civil war, that balkanization. And until next week, this is Billy Roper for The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, right here on the Radio Aryan, reminding you to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Give the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.